Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Before we get to my conversation with DJ EFN, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. My guest is a legend in Miami hip-hop and a trailblazer in the podcast game. DJ EFN, a.k.a. Eric Narciandi, came up in the 90s and early 2000s, dropping dozens of mixtapes that didn't just put him and his crew on the map. He helped put South Florida on the map. And as we get into in this conversation, he wasn't about to settle with just music. He started an international documentary series and is one of the creators of one of the most successful podcasts, Drink Champs. But his story doesn't start in Miami. It starts in Southern California.
My parents separated pretty early in my life, you know, and I was still very young. And so my mom and I moved to an area called Southgate, where I had family. I had cousins and uncles and an aunt that lived in Southgate, and which is like a lot of people might know Southgate in terms of like the hip hop world at Cypress Hill. And those guys are kind of from that area as well. And my grandparents lived in Inglewood, in LA, and I used to be there a lot, like almost every weekend in Inglewood as well.
Parents both Cuban?
Yeah. Yep.
How did they end up in LA?
So the way that it went down is that early on, before Miami is known as this like Cuban Mecca, right?
Yeah.
When the revolution happened in Cuba, and there started to be this kind of like slow, significant, but it was a slower migration of people starting to come through. And the folks in South Florida, from what I know, they didn't really want all these Cubans in Miami or in South Florida. And the government didn't want any issues either. So they were trying to disperse these immigrants that were coming in, and they were offering, like, they had there's this building called the Freedom Tower, which I'm sure is the same. When my parents came, they probably went through something like that.
Yeah.
And they would get like processed, and they would offer the immigrants, like, okay, or the migrants, or however you want to put it. So they're like, they offer them a free bus ticket to anywhere in the country. And it was kind of like to soften the impact of all these people coming into Miami. That might have been,
yeah,
you could look at it if it was, you know, racially or some, you know, inclined, like something, you know, racist in a sense, or maybe it was just some smart economic thing that they just didn't have the resources to deal with all this in one place. I don't know what it was, but they threw them all over the place. And I had family that ended up in New Jersey. There's like a concentration of Cubans in New Jersey. There's concentration of Cubans, small concentration all over the country because of this.
Yeah.
And my dad, though, he didn't end up there because of that. He was in a program that some would say the CIA had a hand in it, but they were smuggling kids. They were in conjunction with the Catholic Church, and they were smuggling kids out of Cuba, and they were sending them to orphanages. And my dad ended up at 13 years old in an orphanage in Washington State, which I think is insane for this like little kid.
Oh man, what a change.
From a Caribbean island, speaks only Spanish, has a decent life at the time because my grandparents were well off in Cuba. And all of a sudden he's an orphan in Washington State, you know, in the snow, and doesn't speak a lick of English. So that was traumatic for him. And then when he was of age, he volunteered for the Marines to go to Vietnam. And then after Vietnam, because he was based in California, in San Diego, that's how he was there. And he met my mom, who ended up in L.A.
That's one of the reasons you're super supportive of veterans and just always have a hand in that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't have a great relationship with my father. And he's definitely, you know, had it rough and been rough with us. But I don't, like, I kind of like don't blame him. I forgive him. And I see the effects that everything's had to him, but in the war and all of that. So I have like a soft spot for veterans, and I myself wanted to be in the service, but my mom was like really against it because of my father and everything that we saw with him. And And then eventually it just ROTC turned me away from it. I was like, I went to ROTC and I had these like little guys telling me to like salute and, you know, get in formation. And I was like, I just want to get a gun and go out there and start shooting people. This is not what I want to do. So I was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
10 or 11, give or take, you guys up and move to Miami.
So my dad moves, my parents separate. My dad moves to Miami in the 80s because that's what a lot of Latinos were doing. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Cocaine Cowboys.
Yeah.
I mean, basically there was just a lot of money out here to be gotten. And my dad's like this veteran, you know, decorated veteran. And he went to college after the Marines. And so he had like an accounting degree. So all this stuff was, you know, really good for Miami in the 80s.
The smile on your face right now is so good.
I mean, because it's funny because as a kid, you don't know these things.
Yeah.
You just know that me and my mom are struggling in LA. We come to Miami and my dad's like hood rich.
Yeah.
You know, like he's got the Corvette and my mom gives my mom a Firebird, a brand new, and we're like, I have my own room, go back to LA and we're in a, you know, one bedroom apartment in the hood. Like,
yeah,
it was
yeah.
just, it's crazy. But we made that move actually like 3 or 4 times back and forth because my dad was increasingly getting worse with PTSD, drugs and alcohol played a part in it. Just everything whatever he was involved in.
And Miami in the 80s is no place for somebody recovering and who needs help and is not getting it.
Not at all. I remember hearing, you know, him. I remember him having flashbacks and just things getting wild at home. And we would like leave in the middle of the night. My mom and I, like, she'd like pack everything up. Let's go. Cause she was scared that if he caught us, something would go wrong. So I just remember going to the airport in the middle of the night or at night, you know, and then wake up in LA at my family's house in Southgate. So, but finally we stayed at one point where my mom decided, okay, I'm just going to go through the divorce, completely detached, but we'll just stay here in Miami.
Yeah.
And that was around like 10, 11.
Brothers, sisters?
No, only child.
Wow. I know a lot of Latino families, an only child is rare.
Yeah, man, it is rare. And it's crazy because my girl's also an only child, so that's what kind of pushed us to have a second child.
The two in the world found each other.
Yeah, basically.
So where in Miami did you guys settle? I worked in Miami from 04 to 07, and I regret not spending like just a little bit of extra money to just get some rat hole on South Beach to live for 6 months just to experience it. I ended up in Davie. Right across from Nova Southeastern. Could not have been more different than South Beach. I think I only went to South Beach, Miami Beach, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 times in the 3 years I was there. Did not live the Miami life like I should have, but I lived in Davie for a couple of years, lived in Fort Lauderdale for a year before I moved back to LA. So where in Miami did you guys settle down?
An area called Kendall, which I currently reside in.
Okay.
And then looking back or finding things out as an adult in that movie Cocaine Cowboys, Kendall was like the suburb that the drug dealers built for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they financed everything that happened and they lived in this suburb. So it explained a lot of craziness that as a kid that I was like, this isn't a normal, like, you know, this is supposed to be a nice neighborhood and it's not that nice. You know?
But here's the thing though, set me up because if my timing is all right here, you may have been in LA for that Whittier earthquake in 87, or you might have been moving back and forth, because I remember I grew up in Covina, so not too far from where you were living, and I remember in 1987 walking to my middle school PE class even before class was starting, and that earthquake hit. But you may have already been in Miami. Maybe.
You know what's crazy? You just fucked me up because I wasn't there. My dad was there. And so I'm trying to remember because that whole time period is very blurry for me. A lot happened in a small span of time. And I was young.
I can imagine. I was actually going to ask, like, how much of LA do you remember? Because that's...
Well, LA, I remember, you know, a lot, actually.
Okay.
I didn't want to leave LA. I was happy in LA.
That's home.
Yeah, it was home. I hated Miami when I first got here. But the earthquake thing you mentioned, I think my dad had moved because he moved around a lot. And I think when we finally stayed, he moved back for a moment to get some work or do something.
Yeah.
And he actually was on the highway when that earthquake
hit. Oh, shit.
And some shit went down. Something like that. I don't know. I might be wrong.
What
it's
made
all
me
crazy.
Think of that was because I'm again, my timing, you were probably in Miami for Andrew in 92. Especially in Kendall. That place got rocked.
No, I was in Miami, and I actually, again, going back to the crazy stuff with my dad at this point worked, he became the vice president of this security company, and was his offices were in Times Square in New York. And I went to go visit him with some, like, I just wanted to go to New York with some friends. So I was like, yeah, I'm gonna come visit you.
Yeah, yeah.
And Andrew hit. And I was trying to come back to Miami because my mom was by herself and I couldn't get a flight back.
Yeah, there's just no way. Yeah.
Right. So my flight back to Miami was the first flight allowed into Miami after the earthquake. And I remember flying in and it just looked like an atomic bomb had hit. And this is by the airport, which wasn't the worst area, but just seeing it from the sky, it looked crazy. And then driving back, you know, driving, like, everything was just destroyed.
Yeah.
And we were the first flight in, and that was very memorable. And I feel like I went through Andrew because we didn't have power for like 2 weeks or something. And Kendall was devastated. So I felt like everything, you know, all the repercussions of the storm going through the actual storm itself.
Again, I was only there for 3 years, but I was there for Katrina. Right. I was there for, you know, Ivan and Charlie and Wilma. I was there for all of those. It felt like the three busiest hurricane seasons in the last 50 years I was there for. And South Florida splits into like two groups of people. You either get together and party and ride it out, or you just, you know, board up and that's it.
So I take every single storm serious, but definitely if it's not a 4 and up, because Andrew was a 5, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, unless it's a 4.
Yeah, I'm like, well, you know, like, I still take it serious, but when I was younger, definitely hung out with my friends, made sure my mom was good, stuff was boarded up, you know, I had a store in 97. To 2000, so some storms came around that time, boarded up my store, boarded up my studios when I had that, and, you know, and then partied with my friends. But as you know, as I've gotten older and now family or whatever, I take every storm. I don't party during hurricanes anymore.
where's the music come in? When does it come in? Does it come in when you're in LA or when you get to Miami and maybe you're looking for some identity and looking for a way to just kind of get through all the shit you were going through? Because like you said, you don't exactly have the best relationship with your dad. You and mom are going back and forth. And so you're kind of sinking into some sort of hobby where you can just be you.
Well, the love of music goes as far back as LA. I had older cousins, so I would hear like a lot of disco around the house. You know, I would hear some Latin music with my mom or whatever. I would, you know, and then there's like the 80s pop music that was around. And then movies were a big source of like where I, you know, found music that I loved. Like, I really loved soundtracks to movies, and that's the way I always see music. Like, music is a soundtrack to something. And so it isn't until, you know, junior high though, that I really get into hip hop. Like, up to that point, there was rap music that had infiltrated my playlists in a sense. I was a skater, so I was into punk and thrash. I liked metal. I was just into counterculture music, basically.
Yeah.
Because that's how, you know, I guess I needed that because of whatever my mind state was. And then hip hop came in, which I felt was right in line with counterculture music. And when NWA and Public Enemy, and I'm kind of fast forwarding, but when those two groups came on the scene, then I was like, this is the music right here. And I felt like it was the music of my generation that was, you know, in its infancy, and I wanted to be, at the very least, be a fan of it and like really pay attention to what's happening with it, because I, you know, like documented in a sense. And so that's where the love of hip-hop comes in. And then it wasn't until like graduating high school that I decided, okay, I want to take this serious and actually do something in the music world.
take us to the hip hop scene in Miami, because you've got those LA roots, but of course Miami being its own animal.
South, right?
Yeah.
Southeast,
with,
right.
Where did you draw most of your influence?
So I loved all styles of hip hop, and I loved all kinds of music, but hip hop, you know, became my music. And then Miami scene early on, 2 Live Crew, you couldn't tell me any difference between 2 Live Crew and Run DMC. I mean, I knew the styles were different in terms of like the content of what they were speaking about, but they weren't, I didn't see them as like, oh, there's this, they're different kinds of music. They were both to me in the world of hip hop. And that's how I felt about a lot of music. But what happened locally is that because of so many people coming from New York into Miami, and those people bringing this like hip hop identity with them, and feeling that hip hop is a New York thing, the folks in Miami kind of felt like, okay, well, that's your thing. Hip hop is a New York thing. We do like this Miami music, or they would just be like, we do rap, or we do Miami bass, or we just do my, and there became like this weird split. But I loved it all. And I loved being, I wanted to represent Miami on top of that. And that's one of the things, the focuses that I had, or the mission statements for myself and my crew at the time, was like, we were just into like lyrical hip hop, which most of it happened to be coming from New York. But being from LA, I loved everything coming out of LA. I love everything coming out of the Midwest. If it was just good, I liked it. I didn't care where it was from. But I wanted that from Miami. I wanted lyrical artists coming out of Miami. So that's kind of like what my mission was, my crew's mission. And then I found mixtapes as an outlet to kind of like be able to bring in artists that I thought represented Miami, but then also play all these different songs and kind of showcase my musical taste in terms of hip hop to people.
How much blowback did you get because you had so many styles? And it's like, hey, there's this Miami DJ, he's putting up mixtapes, but half the shit on here is not Miami.
I mean, I didn't get blowback, really a lot of blowback. I mean, I used to get into debates with certain friends. There'd be the debates with the friend that's from New York, that's like this diehard New Yorker, and be like, you guys can never, you know, do real hip hop, or you know, anything coming out of Miami is fake. Or your Bamas, you're Southern. And so then I'd have other debates with people who were like born and bred in Miami, and be like, yeah, that New York crap, we don't listen to that shit, man. That's fucking New York music. And I'm like, it's not New York music. I'm like, do you like, you know, okay, so what's NWA to you? NWA is just rap music. Oh no, it's hip hop. I go, it's all hip hop, you know? And then there's good hip hop, there's bad hip hop, and it's all subjective. It's up to you whether you like it or not, but it's all hip hop. And they were like, no, hip hop is New York. And what's funny is that, to fast forward a little, that mind state stayed here for a while until radio, because radio didn't play hip hop. Like, we didn't have mix shows out here, big mix shows. When they finally started to have like hip hop radio stations, or the mix shows on the big radio stations started playing hip hop, they used the tagline, where hip hop lives. And when that tagline, which was being used around the country, when that tagline got introduced and was being played all the time, then everybody, you know, in Miami was like, oh, okay, it's all hip hop. Now, like, you
know, you're like, I've been doing this for years.
Right, right. But really the blowback came more from we call them FOTs, fake out of towners, the New Yorker type people. The blowback came more from them because they couldn't fathom anybody being into like what they considered real hip hop and repping Miami. And so when I came on the scene repping Miami, and they were just like, that's corny, you know? And I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do? Rep Brooklyn? No, like, that's what I'm fighting against. Like, I'm trying to help create our identity, which I'm not saying we're the only ones. There was other people in Miami that were pushing that too, but we were definitely on the front of that.
Speaking of identity, EFN, your initials, was that always your DJ name? I want to hear some of the rejected names. I want to take me back to that lined paper back in school where it's like, right, you're scribbling this, cross it out. Scribbling this, cross it out.
There was only a handful, and I was just like, I'm not even going to do this to myself. I had Funk E, DJ Funk E. And then DJ E Funk. And then I was like, how about I wanted the E in there.
Yeah.
And
then
I was like, let me just keep it simple and just put my initials. And the only thing that's ever been negative about that is that people are like, you should put dots between them so that people don't call you effing, because people call me effing all the time and it annoys me, but it's like, whatever, I'm used to it.
How long did it take for you to just stop correcting people or start correcting them? Because maybe that, you know, they call you DJ effing. You're not quite standing tall enough where you lean over and you're like, by the way, it's EFN.
I used to do skits on my mixtapes. I did a couple where I would diss people for saying that. Like, I like a whole skit. It's not EFN. It's not FN. It's EFN. But, and it's funny because it'd be people that will know me. And it's almost like, I guess they just can't help themselves to say effin. I don't know. It's like, I don't know what it is, but people just can't help themselves.
Where does Eric stop and become EFN? Or when does EFN stop and become Eric? Like, how much of one is in the other?
I mean, I'd like to think it. There's no, I'm always, because I used my initials, it's always me. You know, I'd like to think that. Now, I'm sure there's people that would argue it, and some people might say, oh, you know, he's a Gemini, so, like, you know, you know, he can be all, you know, be multiple personalities. But
yeah,
I'd like to say that I'm always, you know, there's no time where it stops being Eric and starts being EFN or vice versa, you know. But I do know that, of course, if I'm hanging with my friends and we're in the studio, I'm not gonna act like the dad at home, you know, like, you know, there's a different vibe. And also the thing is that my crew, we go back to high school days. So it's like, we never left that mentality. We're immature in that sense, you know, cause we're around, we still have the same, we crack on each other. It's all the same, you know, immature jokes that we have with each other. So it's like, we haven't grown up. Like, I always want to act age appropriate in terms of like, I'm growing, I'm maturing, I'm evolving. And, you know, I'm not the person I was last year or 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
When my wife and I were expecting our first, before we found out that we were having a girl, I guess I just always grew up kind of imagining that I was going to be the dad of a son. As an only child, I didn't know any different. It's not as if, oh, okay, it could go either way. I just kind of always imagined, you know, having a son. And then when we found out we were having a girl, I couldn't imagine anything else at that point. Mm-hmm. Talk about that moment you found out that you were going to have a daughter.
Well, I mean, as soon as I found out, I was happy because I had, my friends all had kids when we were young. So I've been an uncle basically and a godfather for as long as I could remember. And specifically, I have three goddaughters and I really, really enjoy being their godfather and enjoy it still. They're adults now. So through that experience, I was like, I want a girl, and I couldn't imagine having a boy. So it switched in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was ecstatic to find out we were having a girl. And then when it was found out a boy, I was actually worried, like, oh man, I got to deal with a little boy now.
I know. That's why when we found out we're having our second girl, I was like, oh, thank God. I don't want to deal with another species. I've totally gotten used to just dealing with a girl.
Yeah, his little wiener. He's going to be flinging it. He's going to touch it. What is he going to do with that? I don't want to deal with that little wiener now. Like,
I like it. Dads immediately go to there like, oh, you know, he's going to play with it. You know, he's going to mess with it. Oh, God. So Eric River Mateo. Okay. Yeah. Did at any point you decide, okay, we're just going to maybe ease up on the number of names we're going to give this child?
Actually, I don't know why I feel like my girl wanted to add something else. I guess the river is what we added. Mateo's my grandfather on my dad's side, the one that lived in Inglewood. That's his name. And the river, my girl just felt like she didn't have any representation in the name. And then I felt, you know, it was cool. My girl's half Native American. And so, you know, we gave Rain to my daughter as her middle name. And it's funny because he ended up being born on a day that rained and he was a water birth, which wasn't planned 100%.
That wasn't planned?
No, we wanted to do it. And there was an option because we were in a birthing center. Like, there's a tub there. So it was definitely an option, but it wasn't planned that that's what was going to happen because anything could happen.
Right.
It just happened to be like, we're there in the room. They're like, do you want to go into the tub? And she's like, yeah, sure. But and he ended up being born in the tub.
We've got this game plan, but over here, this tub's available if you'd like.
So yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. You know, his name being River and raining outside and born in water.
You talk about you had a store 97. So we're going on almost 25 years.
93 is when I incorporated my company.
Oh, so almost 30 years now we're talking about.
Yeah.
What are some things that really kind of stand out to you as milestone kind of watermarks? From this day on, it was different for X number of years. And then from this day on, it changed again.
Going to the How Can I Be Down music conference in Miami, which was 94, if I'm not wrong. That changed everything because I was able to network with people. I had, you know, had no connections to anybody in the industry. And then people thought I was insane to think that I was going to be able to carve any kind of career in the music industry and in hip hop specifically. So going to that conference was a game changer because it allowed me to network with people that otherwise I wouldn't network with. And I was able to get drops. You know, drops getting like shout outs.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
For my mixtapes from these national artists that otherwise I wouldn't get anything from. And then put those on when I started my mixtape, because I hadn't officially started my mixtape series. I was doing mixtapes for like friends, but I wasn't confident enough to launch and say, yeah, I'm gonna push now and put them in like the flea markets and the stores and stuff. So getting those drops gave me that confidence that, oh, I got these drops that nobody else can really get. And it kind of like puts me on the map. Like, who's this Miami guy? And I was making all the artists that I would get drops from say something, either say my crew name, which is Crazy Hood Productions, or say something about Miami, or both. I would try to get them to do both.
Yeah.
So having these artists say Miami or crazy, like it was just at that time, it sounds like something simple, but it was huge. And putting that on a tape and setting off the tape with that set me apart from any other mixtape DJ that tried to do it out of Miami, and then put me kind of like in direct competition with all these bigger mixtape DJs coming out of New York.
Right.
And so that from that point on, things changed from the mixtape standpoint, which the mixtapes always led everything that I was doing with my company, with myself and my brand. It just led the way. And then the next milestone was the completion and finally the release of the group, The Alliance, The All, which was this group that I put together. And we recorded an album and we released it. And although it's not like we sold a bunch of records or we did anything crazy with it, but just the idea that we started something that at that time seemed very difficult to do for some kids, you know, and we put it together and we got it released nationally, internationally, actually. Was a big deal for us, and it was a huge milestone, and we celebrated as if we went platinum that day. Is the way we made plaques for ourselves. That's one thing that I would do whenever we completed a project in my company. I'd make plaques. We'd throw a release party and give each other plaques, and I'm sure people would look at us in the audience like, those plaques aren't, you didn't go platinum, guys, you know? And we would be like so happy. But it was just our way of like just like celebrating, because nobody else is going to celebrate it, you know, for us. It's just celebrating that we're completing something, and I think it's worth celebrating. And so that first album was extremely special to complete it. And it really set the tone for continuing to complete anything that we started or anything we put our minds to that we could actually do it.
You have the podcast, Drink Champs. It's going on, what, is it 5 years
five
now?
5 years, March of 2016.
This is the anniversary month here. Was starting that podcast similar to the How Can I Be Down conference back in 93 or 4? Did it kind of feel like that? Okay, you're stepping into an arena where you're not quite used to it. You get that rush, that excitement. Let's start something new again.
I don't know that it gave me that same feeling from the conference, just because I was already, you know, experienced, well-seasoned. And I was already used to pivoting constantly to do different things because to keep me in the game, which I learned early on, like, you know, you have to fund the dream by all means necessary and do, you know, pivot to relatable things so that you stay within the dream. So it didn't really feel that different in terms of doing it. But what felt different is, like, I always, at that time, in that time frame, you know, things going viral, like, it interested me. It to me was always a mystery. Like, do things really go viral, or are they Russian bots that make everything go viral? Like, right. Like I just didn't understand like this whole viral thing that, you know, I knew what marketing and promotions was because I did it. I knew that you promote long enough, people are going to know about it and find out about it. I knew all of that, but something going viral, that just eluded me that, you know, I'm like, how do we go viral? How does anything go viral?
Right.
And then we went viral in a sense. So for it to go viral and for it to be successful and to be an out the box success, something like that had never happened in anything I was doing. Everything else took just a lot of work. But not to say that didn't take a lot of work for it to happen, because I feel that everything I had done before that and other things directly related to what me and Nori did led to that and prepared us for that. But just the sense of just creating a podcast called Drink Champs and then launching it and it being an out the box success, that had never happened in that way to me. And it was new. That was new. And it was a great feeling, man. It was dope. But it also, I also am always like looking around, like saying that, you know, I do believe in the quicker you, you know, you fly or whatever, the faster you fall or something like that, whatever, however that saying
My
goes.
Mom would always say, yeah, the higher you fly, the harder you fall.
Right. So, yeah. You know, I'm always looking out for that as well. But again, going back to saying that it wasn't a quick thing, because everything we had done before had led up to that. And then specifically me and Nori had done specific things years before that, that are like directly tied to ended up, you know, doing that eventually.
Did you ever pull back the reins a little bit and say, hey, this is too much too soon, even though it's 25 years in the making, really, but right. it's too much too soon. We got to pull it back. Otherwise we're going to lose control.
I wouldn't even have the power to do that, because Nori and I are such different people that Nori's like, go like head first. Like, nah, I'm taking this.
I'm dragging you with me if I need to.
He doesn't care. He's like, if I fall off the cliff, then so be it.
Yeah. If somebody listens to the first episode of Drink Champs and the latest episode, what do they hear differently?
A controlled environment versus a not very much controlled environment. And I mean, it's not that it's not controlled right now, but you hear some people that really, you know, are new to the format of podcasting. But not new to doing a show of that kind. But so, and then not knowing what's going to come out of it. So just basically kind of doing a more straightforward conversation, semi Q&A. There's only a couple people. It's in my old office that I had in downtown Miami.
Remind me that obviously the episodes now are televised or they're on video. When did that start? Or was that from day one also?
I had camera crews from day one filming, but the filming was more to create clips for promoting the audio.
It was like, okay, we've just got to promote the podcast, not necessarily be right. A show.
But I was filming from the beginning with the idea of trying to secure a visual deal. I even remember signing the contracts with CBS Radio and telling them, hey guys, I know you're CBS Radio, but you're parent company CBS, you know, can we do a, you know, let's talk about TV. And they looked at me crazy, like, really, you really think that you're already going to try to do a TV show and you think this is a TV show? Like, I feel they underestimated the potential of our show. They thought it was cool, but I definitely think they underestimated it, which showed because we didn't make a penny till 6 months later, because the whole advertising arm of CBS Radio didn't know what to do with this show that just blew up, you know, overnight, and it's called Drink Champs, and people are getting drunk and people are talking crazy, and they didn't know how to sell it.
What's the next milestone for you?
I've been working on this documentary series called Coming Home. Since 2012 was the first trip that we filmed. And it's to make it simple for people, if they ever saw Anthony Bourdain, which everybody nowadays will use that as a reference to like a travel show.
Right.
Which it annoys me, because I was really a fan of Anthony Bourdain and what he did and how he did it. And he basically used his passion in life, which was food, and used that as like the conduit to conversations when he would travel to different countries and learn about that country through the way he knew to start conversations, which was through food. And that's how I feel about my series using hip hop music and hip hop culture. And so I started this. The first film we did was going to Cuba in 2012. And then we went to Peru. We went to Haiti, Vietnam, Colombia, which has never been seen, and we're in post-production for South Africa, and I'm in the midst of conversations to do more with the series. And so I'm looking to that as one of my, you know, next moves, next thing. And then I have the Fatherhoods podcast, which is another podcast I've been doing. And I'm just looking at, you know, getting my hands into things that just can bring passive income into the home and kind of like start to do things that allow me to have more time with my family.
You bring up coming home, Vietnam, and it kind of takes me back to the conversation we had very early on, the idea of your dad was so impacted by his time there. Mm-hmm. What was that trip like for you, and any conversations you may have had with your dad around that whole experience?
That trip was as important to me as me going for the first time to Cuba, which is my parents' homeland. It was just as important to me to go to Vietnam, which never in a million years, as a kid growing up, watching all these Vietnam War movies, fantasizing that I was in Vietnam at one point, playing G.I. Joe, playing, you know, war, all of that stuff, playing paintball, that I ever think I would be step foot into Vietnam. So I really love that, you know, like I have this hashtag, thank you, hip hop. Like, I thank hip hop for where it's taking me and taking me. So it was very impactful to go there, and it meant a lot. And it closed a lot of, it gave me closure, so for lack of better words. And in terms of my father, he watched it. I sent him the link to it. He just said, oh, good work. He didn't say much. He's just, we don't really have that kind of relationship where we talk, get emotional about anything. We're pretty estranged in that sense.
How do you then make sure that nothing like that happens with you and your son?
I mean, one can never say it'll never happen. But you just try, you know, try to rectify the wrongs of our fathers, right? And just do our best.
And I think this conversation, more than any other, in the 30 minutes after we talked, I thought of about, I don't know, 10 more things to talk about. So I'm going to have EFN back on the podcast as part of a series I'm just going to call Stuff We Should Have Talked About. You can connect with EFN at Who's Crazy on Instagram and DJ EFN on Twitter. I'll put all his info in the show notes and a link to the Drink Champs podcast. You can find me at AaronBender.com. Subscribe to the podcast, rate, review, share. We are 5 out of 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Yeah, baby. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me at AaronBender@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Be well.